This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
It's the Daily Digest on The Bigger Picture with Tina Camellia, Lim Soo Ann and Sumitra Selvaraj. If you've just joined us, we were discussing earlier the World Patient Safety Day, and we're moving on to our next story now.
So Eleni Crocker has worked in archaeology for 40 years now, and she has recently made the biggest discovery of her career, the lost city of Tanea, which is mentioned in multiple Greek myths and historical texts. I feel like we need an exciting intro music, adventure-y
like a Lara
type.
Croft kind of.
Yeah.
So anyway, here's a Greek-style Harinidam Sejarah. According to myth, the city was founded by the Trojans sometime around 1100 BC and built by prisoners of war. They chose this spot because it was on the road between Corinth and the ancient settlement of Mycenae. The legendary king Oedipus was said to have been raised here after being sent away as a baby. So you might remember him because he unwittingly killed his father and married his mother.
How to forget?
So Tanea was one of the largest and most prosperous cities in the ancient region of Corinthia in the northern Peloponnese. So until now, however, no one could work out exactly where it was or how it why it disappeared.
So I got to this point in the BBC News article that this story is from, right? And I was honestly wondering, how is it possible, how is it still possible that there are hidden cities in the world, especially when we have access to such cutting-edge technology and all the drones and satellite imaging and all of that? How is it still possible that we are discovering new cities? So that led me to a TED Talk by Sarah Parkak, who is a space archaeologist. She spends her days scouring the Earth's surface using satellite imaging to identify potential archaeological sites. Here she is from the TED stage, giving us an insight into how much more there is to be discovered.
I believe we have barely scratched the surface in terms of what's left to discover. In the Egyptian Delta alone, we've excavated less than 1/1000th of 1% of the total volume of Egyptian sites. When you add to that the thousands of other sites my team and I have discovered, what we thought we knew pales in comparison to what we have left to discover. When you look at the incredible work that my colleagues are doing all around the world and what they're finding, I believe that there are millions of undiscovered archaeological sites left to find. Discovering them will do nothing less than unlock the full potential of our existence.
So the technology that Sarah Parkak uses now allows her to cover ground at an unprecedented pace, right? But for Eleni Crocker back in 1984, even the internet was barely a thing. Now, 1984 was when Crocker got a phone call from some local villagers digging a water channel. They had hit an ancient sarcophagus and broken it in half. Crocker was only 5 years into her career, but already her spidey senses were tingling. What she saw was a vase-shaped coffin that had delicate paintings of lions on the interior, and it contained a skeleton and offerings to the deceased. It was something that she nor anyone else had ever seen before in 1984.
And Crocker knew Tanea was thought to be in that area based on ancient historians' writings, which stated that it was somewhere between Corinth and Mycenae. But her young age, inexperience, and a lack of further evidence made it impossible for her to get a license for excavation. But she wasn't the only one interested in the area, so there were illicit antiquities smugglers who had known about the site for years and would often pay local farmers for vases and coins that the farmers would come across. So in 2010, Crocker worked along the police and informants to intercept the illegal sale of two statues that had been looted nearby. So she finally obtained permission then to dig in the area, and in 2013 the excavation began.
And very quickly, Crocker and her team found more than 40 sarcophagi, part of an ancient road, a mausoleum and a cistern where rituals and sacrifices would have been performed. Typically, this last structure would have been outside the city walls, so they kept going and then houses appeared. Most of the surface level findings had already been taken by looters, of course, but most of the actual city was about 2 meters to 3 meters below ground.
So this issue with, quite a dig, right? But the issue with looters is something that archaeologists the world over grapple with because it ends up messing with the sites and very often irreparably damaging that. In fact, Sarah Parkak shares her own experience from the TED stage about looting in an area that she frequently works in, which is Egypt.
But we have a challenge. Over the last year, we've seen horrible headlines of incredible destruction going on to archaeological sites and massive looting by people like ISIL. ISIL has destroyed temples at Palmyra. Who blows up a temple? They've destroyed the tomb of Jonah. And we've seen looting at sites so rampant, it looks like craters of the moon. Knowing ISIL's desire to destroy modern human lives, it's a natural extension for them to destroy cultural identity as well. Countless invading armies have done the same throughout history. Now, we know that ISIL is profiting from the looting of sites, but we don't know the scale. This means that any object purchased on the market today from the Middle East could potentially be funding terrorism. When a site is looted, it's as if a puzzle, already missing 90% of its pieces, has had the rest obscured beyond recognition. This is ancient identity theft writ large. We know that there are two kinds of looting going on, looting by criminal elements like ISIL, and then more local looting by those that are desperate for money. We would all do the same to feed our families. I don't blame the local looters. I blame the middlemen, the unethical traffickers, and an international art market that exploits often ambiguous or even completely non-existent laws.
So that was Sarah Parkak, space archaeologist, who also believes that finding and protecting all of Earth's hidden gems is going to take more than just professionally trained scientists. And here's the bit that Sue-Ann has been waiting eagerly for. Parkak has also launched Global Explorer, which is an online platform that will teach anyone with a computer and an internet connection to spot archaeological sites in satellite imagery.
I'm sure Sue-Ann is already on that site. Parkak came up with the idea because the most time-consuming part of her job was actually scouring thousands of square miles of satellite imagery for visual anomalies on Earth's surface. So crowdsourcing that process, she hopes, will allow professional archaeologists like herself and her colleagues to speed up the discovery process.
So would you be interested in being an armchair archaeologist, Sue-Ann?
I mean, who wouldn't be? Imagine being the first person to discover a new, an ancient city that hasn't been discovered before. Because it makes it sound quite simple, isn't it? You go to this online platform. It teaches you things to notice, details that will point you towards the possibility of an ancient civilization having resided there, and then you inform the relevant people or archaeologists or authorities who will then go and discover, and then potentially you could be one of the first few people to have noticed that site.
Yeah, because that's the same thing that's been done with space exploration as well and finding new stars or new systems.
SETI as well.
Yeah,
yes.
It's crowdsourced and people, recreational astronomers have discovered new stars.
Well, to be fair, if you do go on to Global Explorer, before you can actually be part of the team, I think you are supposed to watch like X amount of tutorials, and you have to kind of learn how to spot different, as you said, different kind of features of landscapes and be able to tell apart a hole in the ground from a looting site, which is clearly quite different. And there might be even things like learning how to recognize bulldozer marks, parallel lines in the ground and things like that. But it's fun. Tina, what do you say to being an armchair archaeologist?
I am not very good with... Well, actually, I do spend a lot of time in front of the screen, but this treasure hunting thing, it doesn't work for me. If I just scour so many images for hours and end, most likely not seeing anything... I'm one of those millennials, I suppose, that need instant gratification.
I'm so glad you mentioned instant gratification because, you know, the Greek archaeologist that we talked about, right, Eleni Korka, she was 5 years into her career when she began hearing about Tanaea. And then 40 years into her career, she has made this discovery. Could you wait 35 years for your work to show results?
That's a lot of patience.
It is. I mean, I can't wait 55 minutes for my banana bread to be ready. That's too long. Why can't it be cut down?
That's why we're not archaeologists.
This is true.
That's why we work better with a day-to-day deadline.
Actually, you might be absolutely right about about that. I've got to say, though, that the mystery is far from over, because while they've discovered Tanea and they're discovering various parts of the city, there are still other parts of the city that they have not yet discovered. But the biggest mystery is why it disappeared in the first place. Because they're saying that it was a large city. It was... It was possibly about 100,000 inhabitants. And when you look at other large, similar Greek cities like Sparta and Athens and Corinth, they're still inhabited up to today, right? So what exactly happened? There's no historical kind of... There are one or two clues. They found a cannonball somewhere.
Oh, like a huge cannonball that sunk the whole city?
I don't know if it sunk the whole city, but, you know, it's certainly, you know, destroyed part of it. So it would be interesting. Yeah, it's definitely a story that I'm going to be keeping my eye on from the safety of my armchair.
Absolutely.
So you can keep that conversation going. If you have any thoughts about the story, you can tweet us at BFM Radio. You can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899, or you can even send them through Facebook. Just look us up at BFM The Bigger Picture.
First, some music, then a quick wrap of the hour. Stay with us. Here's Hideaway by the Olivia Tremor Control.
The Bigger Picture on BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
It's Tina, Sue-Ann and Sumitra on the Daily Digest. On the show today, we've learned why we are observing World Patient Safety Day today.
And we have a tweet going on Twitter. We're asking you, what is your main concern when it comes to your safety as a patient? So 69% of you say that it's human error. 21% of you say that it's poor communication, and 10% of you say that it's outdated facilities. So we also have a few tweets and WhatsApps. We have Jasmine saying that, "I honestly cannot choose between poor communication or human error because they can both happen interchangeably. But I'll have to say human error first because I've had doctors who misdiagnosed my symptoms or my relapses a few times. But I also think it's poor communication because I've had doctors who wouldn't listen to my pains, which leads to unnecessary medication for pains that I don't even have." So you also have a few WhatsApps. We have someone saying that, "In my opinion, what I fear the most is human errors because there are cases of blood transfusion which occurs where blood transfused to a patient are from a HIV patient, and that and also the wrong prescription of medication. So therefore, what is most important is the reduction in human errors, and double checking and everything is the best." And then we have another WhatsApp from Go saying that, "I'm a regular at the Clinic Kesehatan, and you'll be shocked to see that 90% of them do not have what you were talking about in your show. So whether, regardless of education, some people might still have low medical literacy, which is important in terms of especially being a responsible patient, but we cannot expect everyone to have the same level of knowledge." So,
yeah, she's also offered a suggestion, which is quite interesting, because you're not just pointing out what are some of the challenges that the healthcare system is facing, but Ms. Goh actually suggested something which is quite interesting, I thought.
Yes, which is to go to a clinic and offer time to volunteer as a translator for patients, to check with the patients whether they are communicating clearer to the nurses and doctors. Most equipments are old and there are a lot of risk for the medical staff. So International Patient Safety Day means nothing if it's just talking about awareness, but we need action.
Oh, that's a wonderful suggestion. I'm sure lots of people would like to follow Ms. Goh's example and volunteer at a clinic because they have that. I think it's a great idea. You're right, because how else would you help somebody along with literacy other than by educating them?
Absolutely. Yeah.
We have one last WhatsApp from Maggie Best saying that, "I think one crucial factor would be the medical management, doctors and staff's attitude. If attitude is right, you will be able to overcome a lot of inconveniences or obstacles. I've had doctors who have asked if I was a hypochondriac when I tried to be a responsible patient. But I've also had doctors and nurses who took the extra mile to allay their fears. And that's why I feel that right attitude from all medical personnel makes a world of difference."
That's true. But I think it's also... the patient's attitude as
I'm
well.
I'm with you on this.
Some patients can be quite entitled. And when I had when I was in the UK for a bit, I was watching a lot of this behind like medical reality shows, mm-hmm. 24 Hours in the A&E or Ambulance, where you're following this the paramedics and the healthcare workers in the hospitals, in the ambulances, and they get a lot of, you know, abuse and, you know, patients being rude and also thinking that their condition could just be like a scratch on their nose.
And it's scarier in those societies where medical malpractice levels are a lot higher as well, right? Just for, you know, being what is perceived as being roughly treated might end up in a lawsuit.
Yeah, absolutely.
So don't forget, the full show on this topic of patient safety will be happening on Friday, October 4th at 4 p.m. So that will be our Health and Living segment with Dr. George Lee and also Chairperson of Patients for Patient Safety Malaysia, Manvir Victor. So you can start sending any questions you have on patient safety to us via WhatsApp, Twitter or Facebook at BFM The Bigger Picture.
Okay, and we also had our second story, which is all about a Greek archaeologist who made the biggest discovery of her career so far, a mythical city that was built by Trojan prisoners of war. We discussed how hidden cities stay hidden and whether Sue Ann is ready to unleash her inner Indiana Jones.
She's already done that during the break, isn't it? And that's a wrap for the Daily Digest today. If you miss any part of the show, you can download the podcast from bfm.my/dailydigest from our BFM app or look us up on Spotify. Coming up at 3 p.m. is Front Row, which with part two of the Endangered Art Forms of Malaysia. To take you to the top of the hour, here is Shaka Khan with Our Loves in Danger. Thanks for listening, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.